Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
You're very welcome back. My next guest this morning has just released her debut novel. She is from County Kilkenny and Orla Mackey joins me in studio and her book is called Mouthing. It's fabulous to have you in.
Thanks so much, Maura. It's great to be here.
Orla, I can't believe this is your first book.
Well, that's great. Thanks a million. It's accidental almost. So I'm delighted that it's getting such a lovely warm reception and so much coverage. It's a little bit overwhelming, but also
certainly is
fantastic. Yeah.
You know what it is? It's a very different book. And just for people listening, give us a synopsis of it.
Okay, so it's based on a rural village in Ireland. It takes a place that from a distance seems completely insignificant, just a little dot on the map, but it's hugely important to the people who live there. And it plays with this idea that there are three sides to every story. So each story is told from three different points of view. And if I was just to give you a flavour of some of the characters, two of my favourites are Mona and Joe, and they're a brother and sister. We meet them at a point in the novel where their tyrant of a father has just died. And Mona is so tired of being controlled that she takes the parish priest hostage, but in a very Irish way. So there are no AK-47s or blindfolds involved. She does something much more serious. She takes control of his heating and she steals money from mass cards and she hides his medication and sells anything that isn't nailed down. She puts it up on the buy and sell. So then there's Joe, her brother, who becomes so lonely as a result of Mona living with the parish priest that he takes a cow into his living room for company.
I know it sounds kind of weird, right? But I have to just, I'm going to pull back because I handed you my copy of the book, which
you
I
did.
Have to say now, I don't even want to let it out of my paw. But I'm going to bring you back to the first page of the book. And this is the family we're talking about, the Muldownies. We start with them. Can you read a little bit for
sure,
people?
Sure, I'd be delighted. Thanks a million. So this is Mona Muldowney, 1963. It was a summer's day. We were sent for cabbage, two heads of it, down the road to Jack Costigan's. Tidy rows of vegetables ribbed Jack's garden. Worry tangled our minds. I don't think she really needed the cabbage, Mammy. Not as a matter of urgency. But she didn't need us either, listening behind doors, trying to make sense of the hush that had fallen on the house. We were set to work after the long walk back from Jack's, knowing not to ask questions, we peeled and buttered, sliced and rolled. The tarts came out lovely, happy with that, and the pavlova rose to a great height, lifted. But that wasn't enough to take it away. The silence, the sadness, if that's what you'd call it.
Right, give me the book back now before you try and steal it on me. Now that, for me, set up the whole story. Because I'm from the country, I'm from the Aran Islands. And did you grow up in the country?
I did. I'm from a small village in North Kilkenny called Gathabon. And it's a place like Ballyroan, but Ballyroan is completely fictional. But it's a place that's hugely important to me. And I really identify with John McGahern, who said that the local is universal, because there's often this idea that the big stuff of life only happens in cities or towns. But wherever we find people, we find a commonality of experience, and there'll always be grief and loneliness and loss and stigma. And my idea in writing this book was to create a village that represented all villages across Ireland.
And as Brendan Kennelly said, if life in little places dies, greater places share the loss. And you've got that at the beginning of your book as well. And that is so true. But getting back to the Muldowney family. So that's the beginning. The father dies. The guy you were telling us was the tyrant. But the way this is written. So the first, for me, the first chapter is written in such short sentences, some one word sentences. And is that to convey the kind of nervousness and chaos that is happening at that time, or the shock almost they're in as a family when the patriarch passes?
I like that idea, but really what I was trying to do when I was writing this was to capture the real life rhythms of the language of rural Ireland. And I think that's often lost, and we have this tendency at the moment to speak in transatlantic accents, and I wanted to capture something that's almost endangered, really.
Yeah, like Crater, C-R-A-Y-T-U-R-E. You see, one of the lads upstairs is not from the country like us two, right? And he read this, the book as well, and he didn't relate to it the same way I related to it, because the nuances that you talk about in the book that are such part of everyday life in the country, a city slicker finds that hard to kind of grasp, especially something like a funeral. Like in the book, the mother here, Mrs. Muldowney, she washes the father's teeth about a million times with, and they're not real teeth. They're actually his false teeth. And then she puts them into him in the coffin.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you mentioned funerals, because funerals are such a big deal where I come from, and they're done so well. And unfortunately, we had a loss in our family recently. But it's the most beautiful thing when you see such a show of support from...
And send-off.
Yes, and such a great send-off. And the amount of comfort that comes from that is amazing. And I suppose as a result of seeing so many funerals and seeing them being done so beautifully, this is something that I've kind of taken inwards and brought into the book.
You certainly did. And you paint the great pictures, and that is... You know, the best thing as a writer can do. Sometimes flowery language for me is lost on me sometimes when I'm reading, that it's surplus to demand in my own. That's just me now. But I just want people to paint pictures in my mind, and you have with this. As we go on through the book, and as we, as you said, see the characters from so many different perspectives, Joe, the brother of Mona, as you mentioned there, takes the cow into the house. It reminded me of the Banshees of Inisherin, where Colin Farrell took the horse into the house.
That's gas, because I went to see the Banshees of Inisherin with my best friend Joey, and when we were watching it in the cinema, my book had been taken on and was well in the process.
You had written it first.
I had written it first, and I gave Joey a belt beside me and said, I don't believe it, I'm actually raging, because it will look like I've somehow plagiarised the film. But and a lot of people thought the Banshees of Inisherin was a little bit fantastical, and
no,
but I didn't at all. I really, really related to it, and I really enjoyed it.
No, yeah. You're right, and I was the same. But the idea as well, if you talk about the Banshees of Inisherin as well, that it depicted, you know, mental health, sadness, depression in rural Ireland, and when Joe in your book took the cow into the house, he did it for a reason.
Yeah, and. Like that, I think it seems very unrealistic to begin with.
You can open the water there.
Thank you. Yeah. But I think the stories are told with sympathy, because I really felt sympathy towards the characters. And I hope that comes across. And I hope that people feel that it's an honest and realistic depiction of life in rural Ireland, and I hope they feel it's respectful as well at the same time.
Yeah, but you know what I think is funny as well? We're talking here and we're all wholesome and, you know, talking about funerals and everything, which is so true. But there's also loads of dark humour in this book. Like, seriously, when you are describing that Joe took the door off the house to let the cow in and she wouldn't come in first and all, I mean, it's just, it's laugh out loud stuff.
Well,
you
I'm
obviously
delighted.
Have a bit of dark humour in your head to write this.
Yeah, I think Irish people are naturally really funny, and I think if you look around any pub and you see people are so engaged and so having such a great time and laughing at each other, I think it's really hard to go to comedy shows. Personally, I have no time for sitting down and paying to be entertained, because I find the people around me are so funny, my family and my friends, and often people from the outside might be a little bit shocked at our interactions, particularly people from other countries, and they see that the way we communicate is with affectionate put downs and slagging.
Yeah, that's true.
But there's more love in that than there is in you know, this full-on professions of undying love. So
You're right. And that kind of soliloquy is almost... I love parts where you say stuff like, it drove him queer, that I wasn't paying a blind eye or picking notice on him. It's just so funny, you know, when you read all these things, it just brings me back. But as we move through the book, because you start in the 1960s and it brings us up to the 2000s.
That's right, yeah. So the book spans about 60 years. Yeah, and it goes from the early 60s up to the 2000s. It just follows the ordinary goings on in the village, the disagreements that the locals get tangled up in, and the way their lives pan out.
Mm. You deal with a lot of issues, though, in a funny manner. But sometimes, you know, it's very sad as well. Closeted nuns, unmarried mothers, alcoholic aunts. And that brings me to Kate. I loved that character, Kate.
Thank you. Kate is... Yeah, she's quite a character, all right. And
Kate Kelly.
She's probably one of the more unsympathetic and harder characters.
Oh, she's a total biatch, isn't she? She's horrible.
She is.
So yeah. Her niece gets pregnant and she goes, without giving the whole book away, to America, to New York, to stay with Kate. Now, Kate has a lot of issues, but they're all going back to the past.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a lot of inherited trauma in the book. And what I was doing was I was presenting female characters from different generations and trying to tackle the problems that women have been facing from the dawn of time. So we have the unplanned pregnancy and falling for an older man. We have being the other woman and the loss of a spouse with Anne Trehy and the loss of a child with a more minor character in the book. And so it's not that the theme of female empowerment was a driver. It's more that I was trying to represent all villages across Ireland. And I couldn't do that without representing these issues. But I also, three of the four stories have the male voice. And I think that's important because I feel the male voice is very often lost. And I wanted to represent that as well.
Do you? In what way?
Well, I just think, particularly when you think of the stories of mother and baby homes in Ireland, I'm absolutely fascinated at the fact that it has received, rightly so, so much coverage. But I've never heard from a man whose partner or girlfriend has gone into the home and that they are at the loss of that person and their child as well. I think that perspective must be so interesting because it's not that men are so unfeeling that they don't care to be involved, but they're lost and invisible in the whole story.
Yeah, and that's actually very true because you don't often hear that. Mm. And I suppose oftentimes the man, A, didn't know, or B, wasn't allowed to find out.
Yeah.
So they had to suffer that loss in silence because they didn't go through anything physically.
But surely after the fact, they knew and felt something.
Like Matty, even when you think about how she left him in the book and went off to the States. Yeah, that's very true. That's another side of things that you don't think of. I think also when you look at mental health and how years ago it was the mental home, you know, the psychiatric home that Jomel Downey and his sister Mona ended up in. And really it was all to do with the father and this inherited trauma through the generations. I think that's a theme throughout your book.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of lonely people in the novel and they're all lonely in different ways. And some people might think that tight-knit communities like Ballyroane could be an antidote to loneliness. Mm. And there's definitely a strong feeling of shared responsibility and mutual support that can help people to feel more connected and more engaged when they're from a small village. But at the same time, I don't know if there's a cure for that chronic loneliness that Joe suffers, for example. Mm. And I think the reason I deal with loneliness so much is because I think a lot of people feel lonely at different stages in their lives or some of the time. And that's probably because all of our lives are different and essentially we're the only ones who can know our own journey, if I can use that horrible overused word.
Yeah, and you know, it's really interesting and I think it's well put in one of the chapters here. She did to me what her brother did to her and what his father did to him. Mm. And that really is about the fact that Mona, who you, at the outset of this interview, you talked about how Mona was so mean to the priest and kind of controlled him and took the money and basically made him feel like nothing.
Yeah.
But she did that because she had been traumatized herself.
Yeah. And everybody's so hurt and trying to break out of a cycle, but they just don't seem to manage it that well in the end. Mm. But everybody at the same time is making an effort. And I think that's life, isn't it?
It's
just trying
is.
To be better than what's gone before.
Do you think that you had a magical childhood growing up in the country?
Oh, well, I did. Yeah, I was certainly privileged in the sense that I had so much freedom and there was all of the things that come with growing up in the country, like collecting conkers and hazelnuts and building rafts on the river and coming
Enid Blyton type.
Not Enid Blyton type. I absolutely loved Enid Blyton growing up, but we had so little Irish literature. I really do remember reading Under the Hawthorn Tree in school and being blown away because before that it was all Enid Blyton and Roald Dahl and Judy Blume, which I absolutely loved. But it gives you this kind of false idea that literature is something that represents a language that I don't speak and that the people around me don't speak and that that's what good literature is. But when you come when later in life, when I came to writers like Edna O'Brien and John McGahern and Sean O'Casey, and it was just blew my mind because I saw myself represented in their language and their stories. And Irish writers just appeal to me on a much deeper level for that reason, because they're so relatable.
You know, it's almost like we're embarrassed to show our true selves years ago and to use words like creator and how people speak in the country, the parish pump kind of politics, that it wasn't good enough, that we had to look to, you know, British writers to elevate our literature.
Absolutely. And genuinely, for so long, this book was finished and I couldn't even call it a book until someone told me it was one. But because it was this kind of writing, I didn't feel as though it was writing at all. I just thought it was scribbling and me having a play around, because I had this unconscious idea that this isn't what good writing is.
Wow, that's amazing when you think about it. But I suppose we haven't read a lot of this type of writing. Maybe that's why. How did you feel when you went to Trinity College then? Did you feel out of place?
Yeah, absolutely. I felt it was a very alien experience. So you somehow have this impression when you're walking through Front Arch that you're going to go in there and after 4 years come out a different person. But I actually came out more myself than when I started, because it was the sense that when you got there that everybody else was more articulate and more informed, and that kind of forced you into a silence, and that silence made you feel less intelligent and less than. And the result of that is that you really go back into yourself and don't use your voice as much at all. So, I felt that it was a place that wasn't comfortable for me or for someone who sounded like me.
But you know, actually, I'm so glad in one way, because you probably wouldn't have been able to write this book if you had gone all kind of yaw and Americanism. Because really, you were true to yourself. And I always say, cultures rule the world. Isn't that true?
Yes, absolutely.
We do. Yeah. Paul Mescal, us, off we go. No, it is really, really interesting, because you didn't kind of want, and not didn't want, but as you said, you didn't believe you could be a writer, so you became a teacher.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So I'm a primary school teacher. I first studied secondary school teaching, and then I went on and studied primary teaching after that. But currently I work as a homeschool community liaison coordinator. It's a job that I absolutely love, and it's supporting parents to be involved in the educational experience. And it's really, really interesting. A third of your week is made up with home visits. So I get to spend a lot of time in people's houses, and I really enjoy that.
How lucky are they? Will you come to mine?
Absolutely, Maura.
Seriously,
yeah,
this is just brilliant. I'm very excited because you're actually writing your second novel.
That's right.
Is based on one of the characters in Mouthing.
Yeah, so it takes a very minor character from Mouthing, and that's the character of the Undertaker, the guy who the teeth are handed over to.
Yeah.
And so it kind of explodes his life into a full book.
Yeah.
And I'm really enjoying writing that.
Actually, it's very interesting, because it just came back to me there now at the beginning of the book. That Undertaker said to the mother, Mrs. Muldowney, that it was really important to put the teeth into her husband's, because it filled his face out and made him look better in the coffin.
Yeah, yeah.
And the whole family realised it did. It is a pleasure to talk to you, Orla. It really, really is. Mouthing, everyone should run out and get this book, because it really is fab. Actually, Laurie and Meath has been on to us already. Can't wait to read this book. Reminds me of That They May Face the Rising Sun.
Oh, wow. That's a fantastic
read
compliment.
That book three times, says Laurie. Orla Mackey, Mouthing. It is in all good bookshops now. Thank you so much.
Email Oliver@rte.ie.